are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighborhood Fall Membership Drive, taking place now through September 21st. Your contribution goes towards Grassroot Community Radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons.
And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
Would you hold my hand if I saw you in heaven? Would you help me stand?
Listening to KBOO FM 90.7 Community Radio. You are tuning in to Once Upon a Time, hosted by Consuela.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. Here we are, another Friday, and we start the program today with Eric Clapton, wonderful song dedicated to the death of his son called Tears on Heaven. And I chose this song because we have a very special program, as every other Friday. And our guest today is a Canadian. She is in Ontario, Canada. Her name is Alyssa Wormland. And we are going to talk about stories of grief. We want to bring one more time a reflection about what does it mean to write and to express our feeling and helping us to heal. I will read to begin a thought that I think is very thought that I think a thought that I found that is very interesting in relation to our subject today. Happiness is beneficial for the body, but it's grief that develops the power of our mind. Keep this sentence in our mind, and we will learn a lot today about one of the most common emotions, such as sorrow, sadness, depression, and also grief. But before we do that, we need to support our wonderful station, and we have a great fall membership, and with the subject Wake Up the Neighborhood. So you know that our station support program like this one and many others. So please be generous and compassionate, and so this way we can keep going as long as we can. And you can give to kboo.fm-give. Your membership will be greatly appreciated and will bring so many joys to so many people. Okay, here we are. So I will introduce Alisa. I am ready for you.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly well. How are you today?
Awesome. I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Still excited as you. We wrote this morning at about 6 o'clock in the morning my time.
Yes, I am. I used to host a show on a community radio station, so it's nice to be on a community station, and I love what you're doing.
Okay, very good. You are a very prolific woman who is involved with so many things. But to start, can you introduce yourself, please, Ali?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of Grief Stories, which we're going to be talking a bunch about today. I also sit on the board of directors for the Leche League Canada and spend a lot of time doing lactation support with families. And I'm doing my master's in counseling psychology right now, and I'm hoping to specialize in grief, perinatal mental health, children and families. I have two little boys, and I live in northern Ontario, about 6 hours north of Toronto. And I love the ways that people tell their stories, and I love the ways that we're able to connect through those stories, even when it's around topics like grief.
Yeah, I agree. And tell us how the idea came about.
Yeah, so Grief Stories got started because of a man named Sean Danby and his wife. She had a very serious form of breast cancer and ended up dying. And Sean found himself just repeatedly awake at like 3 a.m, all alone, deeply in grief. And Sean's a filmmaker. So he is someone who would, you know, pull up his phone or his iPad or whatever, and he would search up stories about grief, hoping that he wouldn't feel quite so alone. And Sean ended up finding mostly just text, which wasn't helpful to him as someone who, you know, does filmmaking for a living. He's someone who really wanted that visual. He wanted to see someone's face talking about what was going on for them and how they were coping. And so he mentioned this to his friend Rob Portley, another filmmaker, and Rob said, well, why don't we try and fill that gap? Let's do that. And Rob really took that idea and ran with it. So he started to create short films with people with their stories and also with professionals with some insights from that perspective, and started creating videos. And from that, there also grew a podcast and also some blog posts. And now we have a pretty prominent social media feed as well.
Okay, very interesting how this came because of a very intense and profound, deep feeling of grief, and create this wonderful foundation. And you are in charge, and you have wonderful stories about people that they're sharing their grief and how they deal with that in a daily life, daily day.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, when I talk to people about what I do for a living, something they say to me all the time is, wow, that's really heavy. And my response is, you know, it can be heavy for sure. Certainly feels heavy sometimes. But there's such a good opportunity for connection through those stories. And that's something I love about my job, is that I get to help create some of these films, and I get to read all of these blog posts, and I get to listen to the podcast. We're about to actually rebrand our podcast, and I'm going to co-host with another person from our healthcare pillar. So it's been really incredible to be able to just hear all of these different ways that people have experienced grief, and then also what they're doing about it.
Very good. And I will read, about what the philosopher has responded to the idea of death in different way. I thought it would be interesting to bring people who are or were thinking about an experience, because nobody is out of this experience of grief in our life. Kierkegaard saw it as a door to faith. That is one possibility. Heidegger as a way to meaning, to find meaning to life. And Camus, the absurdity of it all. You see? So I am sure that in the story that you heard and read, there are these three possibilities, people. We used to find in our time of sorrow, we looked for spirituality, meditation, Buddhas, and all kind of, not necessarily religion, but I will say spirituality. And also we look for a way to find a meaning to our life. Or a meaning why this happened, why this kid who was only 5 years old died. Doesn't make any sense, isn't it? And at the end, also, there are other group of people who said, this is completely absurd. I don't want to know anything about it. And I don't get it. I don't want to deal with this. And it will pass. I don't know. I will not do anything because it's so weird, absurd, and I don't understand.
Yeah, and you know what? I would say the theme that I'm noticing the most, especially lately, has been people really talking about integrating grief and integrating concepts of death and the experience of death into their lives. So rather than, you know, letting grief feel like something that is just incredibly heavy and that's kind of something that is weighing on them all the time, it's about finding ways to make space for those feelings associated with that grief into life, rather than, you know, kind of pushing it down until it feels too big.
Yeah, I think that is the most intelligent way of dealing with, because we have to integrate to our life. We have lost many people, even our pet. I was thinking this morning how much I grieve my pets, to the point that sometimes I want to have another one, but the whole thought of that I will have to go through that again, I am not yet ready. And my last pet died 10 years ago. Can you believe? So those feelings are sometimes, if you don't control, and I am sure you are going to speak about that, we have to control our mind and our feeling, because otherwise they will take over and it's danger. What do you think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's really about making space for them, because it is such an existential thing, like a quintessential existential thing to grapple with death and that concept and surviving after people in our lives that were important to us have died. I mean, it's a whole new way of being in the world, right?
Right.
So I think it's something that is just simply too big and too important to who we are and how we are in the world to do anything but acknowledge it and to be with it.
Okay, I would like to remind our audience that we are here with Alisa talking about grief and art and grief, but we will talk about art a little bit later. And our phone number here is 503-231-8187, and we are ready here with our wonderful Annie, who is helping us. And anything you want to comment, ask, tell your story, you are free to do it, and we will be very happy to share with you whatever is going on with your life in terms of this subject, or maybe not now in your life, but before, and how you dealt with that situation. And I have a question for you. How can we define grief?
Good question.
What does it mean? Is it?
I feel like the experience of grief is so unique, but to define the concept, something that might get kind of close to defining grief for me is like the feelings that, or the groups of feelings that are left over after the loss of a person, a place, a thing, an experience.
Very good. This is exactly the definition that I found. The experience of coping. Yeah, the definition said, because I was I have been going through a grief period also the last 2 years, or even before, the experience of coping with loss.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you said.
Yep. That's good job, me.
But let's go into deeper into what is the experience of loss, because for loss, it's not only that somebody die, like a relative, a friend, a lover, or a pet. It's also the loss of a job. It's a loss of a project. It's a loss of an idea. It's a loss of a situation that we had expectation, or we were doing something very regularly, and suddenly it's not there anymore. It's also we go into grief. My husband, for example, when he retired from OSU, he went through a period of loss and mourning, because he missed so much his work. His identity more than his work. His identity was, so I told him without even know about you, I said, you are going through a period of mourning because you are losing, you are feeling that you lost your identity.
Yeah, it's so true. A form of non-person loss, more identity-based loss that I've been hearing a lot about lately is infertility.
Yeah. Hello.
Right? People grieving their fertility and their expectations around what their family might look like.
Yeah, that could be. I think it's a wider definition of what does it mean loss.
But
we both agree. I don't hear you very well now, Ali.
Oh. Interesting. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yes. Now I can hear. Here I have another question. Which are the symptoms of grief?
So most of us in the grief space don't do a lot of pathologizing of grief. So we don't really consider symptoms. There is a new diagnosis actually in the DSM, in the most recent edition, that is about a prolonged grief disorder. So people can look those symptoms up if they're really interested in knowing them. But for me, you might know that you're grieving if, you know, you experience some sort of loss and you feel that space, that thing or that person or that part of yourself used to occupy. And that's something that, you know, can feel sad, and it can feel lonely. It can look like you know, exploring memories and wanting to share stories. It can also be really deeply painful.
Yeah, and I take all your energy.
Yes, it's very draining.
Are you is your radio on? You should turn down your radio, because that is the interaction that interfere with our conversation.
No, it's not.
Oh, it's not. Okay, so it's something else. And another thing I wanted to... What is the difference between melancholic and depression and grief? They are relative. They're relative, but they are not exactly the same. What is your opinion?
Yeah, so depression tends to be more debilitating. It tends to interfere with the ability to function more so than melancholy would. Rather than that, like, you know, it kind of subtle sadness. It's a much more intense feeling that can feel really quite overwhelming, like having a dark blanket pulled over you, you know. And with grief, that's something that's more natural. It's something that just is inevitable. It's just a human experience that can incorporate depression or melancholy or you know, anything in between.
Yeah, I have the feeling, as a person who suffered of depression when I was younger, that depression is something more permanent. We are talking about clinical depression. And the grief and the melancholia is... No, it's not as permanent, it's intermittent, because the feeling, the intensity of the grief is, of course, the first year, second year, could be even the five first years, but it gradually goes down. it should be, and usually it does. And the melancholia is something that is also in a transit situation, something that caused that you feel that you are very sad and in a state of mourning. What do you think?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, depression is something that it does tend to hang on for a longer time. I don't know that it's necessarily permanent, but it certainly can be, and it certainly can feel that way for a lot of people.
More permanent in relation to the other two. This is the comparison I am making. Not that it's permanent for all your life. Okay?
Yeah.
I hopefully we have so many medication and many way that we are treated the people with that kind of problem. Freud defined mourning as a state of melancholia. He wrote a wonderful essay about melancholia, and I read it many, many times. And because it's a different, but it's very close to grief, in my opinion. Because even right now, for example, somebody who leaves their country, we have the feeling of a homesick. That is a kind of mourning, too. You see? So,
and for sure.
So there are so many, because the complexity of the emotion of grief, because it's emotion, it's feeling, it's the loss, it's a lot of complexity in one word.
Definitely. And it feels so unique to each person, you know. Some people's experiences of grief are, you know, very numbing.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, some people said, I don't want to talk about it. When I think it's the worst, the best thing is to talk about it, especially if you have a friend who can listen to you. Okay, so let's go to your story. A ver, share with us some of the story that you have.
Okay, so the first story I want to share is by John Lewis Clark. And he shares about when his wife died. So this is a blog post that he wrote.
Good.
When my wife of 18 years died in 2016, I became a single father, missing the love of my life, and also had to learn how to raise two girls, 13 and 17 at the time, on my own. I remember a conversation I had with my mother-in-law and oldest daughter that began as reminiscing over a person who became a lost love of all of us. We all talked about different aspects of my wife, but shortly it transformed into a who meant more to her fest. All our points of view were out of love, but each of us had a different angle for different reasons. My mother-in-law saw my wife's death as the loss of her baby girl, my daughter, as the loss of her mother, and me as the loss of my love. The conversation became elevated because not only was it a sensitive topic, but it had become a comparison. I dubbed this the umbrella effect because it felt like an umbrella that fit three of us but caused each of us to become wet on one side. When my mother-in-law made a comment that got me thinking, I had to back off somewhat my somewhat defensive position. She talked about how she felt when my wife was born. It soon made me think of how my wife felt when our babies were born, and I realized that I was fully the contributor in each case. The connections that my mother-in-law and my daughter had trumped my 18 years automatically. These two ladies had true connections to my wife, love based on biology that I felt beats love based on time and experiences any day. We all had a relevant case, but mine was getting weaker with every statement made. I had to understand that biological connections gave a different justification for reminiscing. As a husband, I was torn between defending my love for my wife and understanding my mother-in-law and my daughter's points of view. Although it hurt, I had to realize the source of the pain. I no longer wanted to be an unconscious contributor to their hurt. I had to realize that everyone mourns loss differently, and comparing only brought more hurt to an already sensitive situation. To alleviate the tension, I grabbed three bowls from my mother-in-law's cupboard, got the scooper and three spoons. I pulled out the cookie dough ice cream, which prompted a truce. Peace is always achievable over ice cream. I now know that although people can be subjected to the same grief, they all process and see it differently. What is good is that everybody remembers hers for the beauty she brought to our family. Although our conversation got contentious at times, it was clear that although we lost her, no one lost the love we have for her.
Oh, how beautiful. And how it's so true what he wrote. Because she was a mother, a wife, and a daughter, and a friend, probably. So we have different role. We are very polyphasetic in so many ways, especially women.
Yeah.
And it's true that everybody, when somebody die, I share the feeling, because when my dad died, was my father, my dad died, no, our dad, you see, because it was mine, only mine. So we have the tendency to appropriate, because it's a feeling of the ego that nobody cares so much as I did, and nobody is suffering as much as I am suffering because she left. What is a kind of infantile, until we realize that we all love that person in a different way, and we have a different relationship with that person.
Yep, exactly. I love that this story talks about, you know, all these different kinds of relationships and how it became a comparison and that didn't work. But what did work was all sitting together and having some ice cream.
Yes, yes.
There's something so, I don't know, I think it's a beautifully written story.
I agree.
With that, you know, it just gets kind of like deep and dark and it's starting to feel a little heavy, and then ice cream comes out and it's perfect. It's exactly what grief is like, right? Those little moments of finding that memory or having that conversation and just having those moments of joy amongst it all, you know?
Yeah, especially for the, it's not that one person suffer more than the other. We suffer in a different way. And like we said before, we express in a different way. The kid, the two girls, 13 and 17, of course they are not going to express the same way than the mother and the husband. They have a completely feeling of abandonment because she left. Okay? And in an age where they needed the most. So that is a kind of a very hard to deal with, that loss. Very, very different.
It sure is.
Even for the husband, it's a different kind of loss, because he has to confront the new responsibility to be in charge of two girls. That is a big responsibility. So I am sure he was afraid. He thought that he will not be able to do it. But he did. I know he did. Okay, do you have another story?
I do. I have lots of stories.
Okay, keep going.
All right, so my next story is written by David Newland. It was originally a blog post that he had written in 2005 that's on his website. So if you Google David Newland, you might be able to find that. Okay. Or you can check out the link on our website on griefstories.org. It's called Mourning a Man I Never Knew.
Oh.
This spring, I turned 54. I've now outlived the father I never knew, my biological father. It's been almost 23 years since we spoke, 18 years since I learned of his death. I'm still dealing with the strange grief of his loss. As an adoptee, I always had questions about my origins that my loving, caring adoptive parents couldn't answer. In my 20s, I applied to child services for more information, and after 8 years of waiting on my part, they did a search in 2000. After some effort, they couldn't find my birth mother, but quickly produced contact info for my biological father. They offered to put us in touch. After jumping through a few official hoops, we emailed back and forth a bit, and finally we spoke on the phone maybe three times in all. I can't even describe what it was like, intense, sparkly honest, humorous, and deep. Here was a man who had made the most of the same mistakes I had, only far worse. Depression, drugs, divorce, family's problems, anger management, women. He had nothing, as far as I could tell, although his stories sometimes conflicted. I didn't hold anything back either. I insisted that he honor my experiences as not adoptee. It wasn't easy for me handling the big hole in my life. He had a hard time understanding that. He said his own kids had it a lot worse than me. He was right, but that wasn't for him to say. I heard it from them. It was good to connect, but I knew he wasn't good for me. I chose not to pursue further connection. I knew he was out there. He knew where I was. There was no contact for a few years, and then one day in January of 2005, I found out he was dead. I was online at work, looking for some information on the original Polish spelling of his last name, and wham! The first thing that came up was a memorial page. He had died nearly a year before, in March 2004, aged 54. I never knew him in life. I still don't know him in death, but I've been grieving him for a long time in my way. In 2016, still reckoning with the hole he left, I went to Red Deer to find his grave. I narrated that journey in a CBC radio documentary, The Heartache and Healing of Finding My Birth Father. I never found a grave, only my own shadow over a 4x4 stake in the ground. I did enjoy a delicious steak sandwich at a local restaurant he was fond of. I've been back to Red Deer twice since then. The last time I went, even the steak was gone. And so was the steak sandwich, restaurant, hotel, and all. The picture on the memorial page linked above is the only likeness I ever saw of my birth father. I always thought I saw my face in his. Now, having reached his age, I see his face in mine.
That is a deep, deep loss. Because it starts...
Layers of loss.
Layers of death. Yeah, that is a reason, because it has been taking the whole life. I mean, you grew up with that sense of abandonment. And that is a loss in itself. And then when they get together, they are not able to communicate to really... It's hard. It's a very, very nice piece of literature. Beautiful.
Beautiful. I know. He's a beautiful writer. He's a great storyteller.
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I feel that. Okay, yeah. So now we can go to... It's not that we are not going to have another story, but I would like to know, because what appealed to me and the way I found you, because was the connection between art and grief. And this program is called Once Upon a Time, because it's about autobiography. And I have been encouraged our audience to write about their life, their grief, their happiness, anything they want. They don't need to publish. It will be nice if they distribute along their family, especially grandchildren and children, because how this country is so big, some people live in the east, some people live in the west, and they lost the daily communication. And when I found that your website said art and grief, and I thought, oh, this is exactly what I have been thinking in my life. And I would like to tell you, or say not to tell you, I would like to ask you, how can art help the grieving feeling? How does art help us with grief, in your opinion?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what I've heard from the art therapists and music therapists that we've talked to is that people who expressive writing as well, expressive writing therapy, is that expressing and really getting those feelings out externally and then making them do something, it can be a really, really powerful thing for being able to work in a tangible way with feelings.
Yeah, but you need to have that talent or that skill or from one day to another. How that work?
Well, I don't think you necessarily need to be skilled at it. It's just about doing it. Because like you were saying, right, you're encouraging your listeners to create, even if it's not something they publish, for example. I don't think that you ever need to show anyone a physical piece of art or show anyone a song that you've written or a piece that you've written. It's just about doing the thing, about getting it out. And there's a few different ways that you can do that. There's some really great resources on our website under our coping tools section. There's a music for healing section, an art for healing section, and a write for healing section.
Yeah.
And the writing section has a whole bunch of really great little prompts and videos with how-tos about things like journaling, for example. There's some ideas for some kind of prompts on there as well.
Can you give us your website? That would be very, very good to know. What is your website?
Yeah, it's griefstories.org.
Okay, very good. I think it's, in my case, or word, I have had a journal since I was 11 until today, until last night. And the latest year has been the Journal of Gratitude. And I think how word create reality, it does help to put it in writing. So this way you can read after that and think, oh, this is the way how I feel. Now I feel better or whatever. So that is very good. And I look also how art has been helping us to grieve. And I found that wonderful, bueno, I knew that wonderful painting by Edvard Munch called Scream. Mm-hmm. That in itself, I mean, when you look at them, when you look at and you're in front of that painting, you feel all his pain. It's so dramatically, it's so powerful. And mm-hmm. and then you read his autobiography and you feel like you get to know him. You share his pain and his anxiety and the grief that he felt during his whole life. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Indeed, you put in your website, I don't know if you put, but the wonderful sculpture by called Melancholy.
Yeah.
Melancholy. Why did you pick that particular piece of art?
It's just one of those ones that kept on coming up when we would kind of ask people what images really resonated with them from grief. This is one that so many people really connected with, and it's that kind of big hole in this person's life, in this case in their body, in the sculpture that I was talking about earlier. On our Art for Healing page as well, some of the specific impacts of art that we've listed include expressing emotions that are hard to put into words, providing a tool to express extreme emotions, providing a break from grief, awakening a childlike spirit, and providing the opportunity for play. Love that one. Yeah. Increasing serotonin, which helps fight depression, and being a form of meditation through healing and grounding.
Very good. Yeah, I knew that sculpture too, but I was thinking about Rodin and I have the thinker. Even the thinker has all the position of somebody who is thinking, but also the expression of the body is helping, is telling you that his thoughts are not very positive. They're very deep, and he's very concentrated in that process of thinking. So that made mm-hmm. me feel that we can compare and contrast with the first one that we spoke, and because they're different material, they're made from different material, but the feeling is the same, that it's very deep what is inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mm-hmm. think? Yeah, because the grief is also goes through the mind. The mind has a lot to do with the grief. It's the way how we feel our grief is one thing, but also the way how we think about our grief.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. All the cognitions that get kind of muddy. One of our guidelines when people submit blog posts to us is we ask people to keep things around 500 words or less.
Yeah.
And the reason we keep it short is because people who are grieving tend to have a really hard time concentrating. Like, those cognitions are slowed down because we are spending so much of our energy and our brain space trying to process this new way of being in the world without the person or experience or animal, whatever it is that they've lost.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that. You have also the music, and the music is very, very good healer as a healing, like a word. And I found, of course, Chopin, the melancholic pieces that he wrote, the Nocturnes and the Mazurka and some of his prelude. Those are very, very relaxing and very sad also, and that helped a lot. And then I chose The Tear of Heaven by Eric Clapton because was that I already said. And then there is another song, very sad, is Back to Black by Amy Winehouse, that is failing a relationship and the loss of love. So mm-hmm. there are so many composer, painter, and musician in general, and all kind of artists. You don't need to be famous. You don't need to be well-known. You just need to express yourself in your journal, as you said, or in any creativity that even a good cooking dish can express mm-hmm. some, because you are cooking the the dish that that person loved, and you are also dedicated to her or to him.
And yeah,
and so I think, in my opinion, for somebody who has been grieving a lot of people, you know, more you live, more you have to say goodbye to your parents, to your brother, to your friend, to your lover, to your husband. It's a long list. And also to the country, mm-hmm. to your pet. So you learn through the process. You learn. So every time, it's not that get easier, but you manage in a little bit, in a little better way. Can you?
Yes.
Can you? Do you think it's possible?
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, it's possible to sit with uncomfortable emotions and to learn how to be better practiced at doing that.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead with the other story. This is a story.
Okay.
Very meaningful.
Okay, so this is a story actually by a friend of mine named Megan Sheffield. She's also a fantastic writer, and she's someone who I met doing community work with in a community in Southern Ontario I used to live in. She does a lot of really great harm reduction work. In the first days of July, there aren't any many flowers blooming, I learned. I sent a text saying, "Hello, friends, I'm putting out a call for flowers. I went to public school with Corey, the young man who died in downtown Coburg this week, and though I hadn't seen him in recent years, I feel the loss of him on a community level, as I imagine you do too. Some of Corey's people are gathering tonight in vigil at the bank where he died, and I'm gathering flowers from those of us who have gardens to share with this grieving community. Do you have some blooms in your garden that you'd be willing to share? Corey died as a result of a toxic drug poisoning that took his life from the bank vestibule where he was sheltering. His friends were grieving, angry, disbelieving. The wider community was in shock that this could happen here in such an ordinary place to a local boy born and raised. Those who knew him best, who had been with him when it became his last days and months, began to talk about holding a vigil, a time and a place to be together in their grief. As it turned out, the tulips and ponies that had faded and finished, and the dahlias and zinnias hadn't begun to flourish yet. I got some nervous replies from the current state of the garden. A mom from my daughter's class texted to say that they were sorry, they just didn't really have much to offer right now. Then the first yes rolled in. Yes, I'll pull something together. We have 1 million daisies. A whole man's life. 1 million daisies. As it turned out, there was an abundance to be had if you knew where to look, if we just widened the margins of the garden and looked at the edges of the wild places. We know that trauma of all kinds is inequitably distributed in our society, and that access to healing resources is even more inequitable. For community members who rely on prohibited, criminalized supply of certain substances, the experience is not just a risk for personal harm, but of compounding losses and grief. It means mourning and isolation because the cause of death is so stigmatized. It means administering the life-saving medicine and performing chest compressions in the glow of flashing lights while still in mourning for the most recent loss. I spent an hour driving around picking up mason jars filled with blooms from doorsteps all over town. There were daylilies and hydrangea, wild vetch and bladderwort, fragrant beet balm and holy basil, and yes, 1 million daisies. At the vigil, the jars of flowers were joined by an eagle feather and abalone shell, offerings of cigarettes and a can of Molson resting on the windowsill outside the bank. Candles were lit, stories were told, tears were shed. Those of us who didn't know Corey well, who were present to show our support, to acknowledge the community and systemic level failures that had led us all to this place, were invited to hold a perimeter of care for those in the center who were grieving by standing at the edges of the gathering. The days after the sunset vigil at the doorstep of an ordinary bank, flowers bloomed on the gray cement sidewalk on Main Street. Wild, fleeting beauty.
Mm. Yeah, it's a beautiful mm-hmm. piece of literature also, and the sense of community. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting community to be in. People actually ended up coming together around this time to create like a community-led overdose prevention site which you know, wasn't supported by everyone in the community, but saved some lives. So the community response that kind of grew out of some of these grief experiences is really inspiring to me anyway.
Yeah, to me too. And that is the reason mm-hmm. we go to the next about talking about community. This is our fall membership drive. So please, all of you who are listening this wonderful program and this wonderful guest, Alisa, has bring it to us a lot of feeling and emotion and reflection. Very profound show today. I am very, very happy and very grateful to her to share her life, part of her life and her experience. So wake up the neighborhood. So keep supporting. And if you are not supporting yet, you can start supporting us at kboo.fm-give. So text kboo to 44321. And you can do anything you want. I mean, everything is appreciated, and it helps to keep going with this wonderful station. And okay, Alisa, let's go to the next one.
Okay. All right. So this is one that I actually wrote.
Oh.
And it's one to go back to what you were talking about earlier about losing a pet.
Yeah.
I lived with a dog named Althea who belonged to my roommate during my undergrad. Every year, my partner, a roommate, and I would go to a summer solstice festival. The year Althea was pregnant, my roommate brought her to the festival. The first night there, he retired to his tent to nap in preparation for the evening's festivities, and my partner and I walked with her around the festival grounds. I noticed her water break, and we had a friend fetch our roommate while we took her to his car, a small place we knew she felt safe. She gave birth to 8 puppies that night as the sky opened and rain poured. I remember catching the puppies one by one, letting Allie clean them, and then handing them to my partner to hold in a towel while she birthed the next. Luna was the 6th puppy born. She had a white-tipped tail and a white crescent moon marking on her forehead. She was the smallest of the litter, but not by much. I knew immediately that she was for me and I was for her. Over the next few years, Luna was by my side while I finished my undergrad, kicked my doctor-sanctioned opioid addiction, and moved to a new community. She couch-surfed with us during a brief period of homelessness, came with me to my first big business job to sleep under my desk, greeted me exuberantly when we brought our son home from the hospital, and hiked hundreds of kilometers with my son and I during the pandemic. The first sign she was unwell was that she was panting a lot. Then she started having accidents. I took her to the vet expecting an antibiotic for a UTI, but our vet did an x-ray and discovered a large tumor. She told me that our girl was in pain and only had a few weeks to months left. I was shocked, and so was my partner, when I shared the news. It was his first real experience with grief, but I was a seasoned professional. We both spoke to therapists and chose to try to make the end of her life as good as possible. I was tortured with the idea of choosing to euthanize her. I didn't know how or when we would be able to make that call. My therapist told me that she had lost a dog the same way and that the day would come when she would look me in the eye and I would know it was time. These are 3 things that helped. 1, connecting with a therapist, my partner, and my peers who could relate. It helped a lot to feel like other people in my network could relate to what I was going through. It felt so heavy and it helped to talk about it and to know I wasn't alone. 2, taking her to an indoor dog pool to do her favorite thing. We wanted to honor things that we knew brought her joy. Luna loved chasing balls and swimming in Lake Ontario, but it was too cold to take her to the lake. So we found an indoor dog pool and took her weekly. It seemed to help with her pain and helped us all find joy amidst the sadness. 3, stamping her paw prints. I ordered a baby footprint kit online and stamped her paws. I framed one and hung it on our living room wall. One day, I hope to get it tattooed. Finally, the day came when, as my therapist had told me would happen, Luna looked at me and I knew she was in pain and didn't want to suffer anymore. We made it through a heartbreaking night and I drove her to the vet as soon as it opened in the morning. I told her she'd feel better soon. She leaned into me, I held her, and my partner and I both told her we loved her and thanked her for everything she had brought to our lives. It was the purest love I've ever known and lost. It was an experience I know so many people can relate to. I believe that grieving her after her death was a little bit easier because I knew we had given her a good life, complete with an excellent life in the end. I think about her often on the trails at the lake as my son grows, and as I prepare to welcome another baby she won't dance for as she meets. Holding space for pet loss is valid and important. It's a type of grief worth making space for.
When I was packing my thing to come to the state, I found in my closet my Yanquitos ashes in, and I start crying. It's not that I forgot that I have his ashes, but I haven't seen it for a long time, and I thought it's time to put it in my yard, and I couldn't, so I kept it there in the garage, in the storage. I couldn't. And this was almost 10 years ago when he died. So I do relate it to your piece, because who hasn't been in that situation? No, but we love pets. Oh, it seemed that we have a call. And so it's a wonderful piece, Alisa. You should have a start with that, but maybe this is, give me a sense of, how can I say? It's so nice to share that feeling of pain and how long it takes, because some people don't, some people don't understand when you said, oh, I have to go and take care of my dog, I have to do this, I have to do that. But why you care so much? It's not just a dog. No, it's not just a dog. He's my friend. He's my loyal friend. He's my confidant. It's my joy. It's everything. I mean, if you haven't had that experience, you will not understand.
Yeah, honestly, some of the most highly engaged with content that we've been putting out lately have been about pet loss.
Okay, you see, perhaps because of the isolation that we are living in this society. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, that's part of, you know, kind of the gap that Grief Stories really hopes to bridge is, you know, we can't always physically be with people in the world the way that it is, but we can connect with people through their stories.
Yeah, that is one way to minimize the pain, because like we were talking before, it does help to share and to be with, to listen to somebody who can give you an opinion on a suggestion, or just listening. See, we are not looking to fit the problem. We are looking for solidarity, empathy. This is what we're looking.
Yes, exactly.
So this is what it is. So we have a call?
Yeah, it's Ender.
Ender. Oh, hi, Ender. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes, I can hear you. I am so pleased you are listening to the program.
Well, I'm a big fan of your program, as you probably know. I think it's one of the best things that that we broadcast at Cable. Well, the Cable is so great, you know, in so many ways. But I just wanted to say that I love to hear about poetry that is about our animal best friends.
Yes.
This is something that it's my favorite genre, if there's such a thing, you know, of literature and poetry and just people talking. I just want to say that, you know, it's so wonderful that, you know, that last poem was
beautiful.
It really, you know, touched me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm one of those people that lost a best friend that I had for the majority of my life, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, it changed everything about me, actually. And I think, you know, what you just said about, like, a lot of people maybe don't understand this bond that a person can have with an animal. Well, that's okay. It's okay. We don't have to understand everything. But that bond can be extremely real. And it's a bond of family.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, and I think that the power of writing our emotions about it is something that helps us, but also helps somebody else, you know, to relate to that emotion and feeling. And I just want to thank you so much for broadcasting this. Yeah.
I agree, and we have to thank Alisa and thank to the coincidence that I look and I found her by, no, it wasn't an accident. I was looking for the connection between art and grief, and I found her and we start communicating, and she was so open and kind, and she said, yes, I will do it. I will do it. And we were talking this morning how excited we were. I said, I am nervous and excited at the same time because it's the first time that I have a guest over the phone. But like my friend said, you don't have any problem talking on the phone, so why are you scared? And Elisa didn't have any problem either. She articulates very well what she does, and all the reading that she has done, the story, are beautiful. And I think our audience should look at her website, and if they are in a situation of grief, they should belong to the group of people that they are sharing their experience, because like you said, it helps others, give you a sense of solidarity, compassion, and empathy. So this is what is wonderful, you see. I am so proud also that you call. It's the first time that you call in a year, and it's in my heart, because you know, this show is very, very close to my heart too, because I think it has the community sense that is important to us as a station, as me also as a person, and the profound feeling of helping people to be better person and happier.
I just want to say something real quick before hanging up, is that I think it's so important, a resource, to talk about grief.
Yeah.
And how important it is to embrace grief and to not be afraid of it, because it's really part of the human experience here.
Not only the human experience, because animals also suffer. I have seen several suffering.
You're right.
Especially when they are abused. When they are abused, they suffer, or when they are abandoned.
Thank you for that correction.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Right.
And Annie, I have to tell you, I am very happy with Annie. So Annie has to come every time you are not here, okay? Okay, Elisa, do you have something to say as we are finishing our program in a few moments, few minutes?
Hello?
No, yes, what happened? No, you are here. You are still here.
I'm
there.
There we go.
Yes. Annie was going one way or another. And so
it's all good. You guys have done so well with managing the tech. I appreciate you taking the call in. One day I'll come show up in Portland, and then I'll come sit down with you again.
I would be very, very pleased to meet you. It would be wonderful. I am very, very happy and very thankful to you for your generosity, Elisa.
Me too. I really appreciate you having me on. And just if people are looking for all of our resources are free. So you can search Grief Stories on any podcast app. And you can find our blog posts and our videos on griefstories.org. You can also find Grief Stories on YouTube. You can watch all our videos there. Everything's free. So please do check it out. And we are a registered charity. So we do run on donations. So if you do find the resources helpful, please do consider a donation. And of course, also if you're considering donations, I just want to make sure you're donating to your local community station, because
very good.
Community
thank
radio
you very
is very important.
I
so.
Think that
thank
pro-
you.
I have a friend who is an artist, so I told her about the program. I don't know if she's listening to the program, but I will tell her later today again, because she can. She is grieving the death of her husband, and today is his birthday. And it would be nice. So, and myself also, I am thinking maybe I will write about the ashes of my Yanquito beautiful baby boy. And
yes, I'd love that.
Yes, that would be nice. And also, I would like to dedicate this program. I dedicate the program to Sandy Good, who just died in August of cancer. Very young, beautiful woman. Who I met her when she was a teenager, and her father was a very close friend of my husband. So I honor her with you, Alyssa, and with everybody who is going through the process of grieving. And to end the program, we have Chopin, Frédéric Chopin, and to keep our soul in peace and to look at forward what the future has to bring. Bye-bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, my dear. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM and streaming on the web, kboo.fm. I'm Don Jacobson, and moving on, we'll be here in just a few minutes right after the news.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy viernes 6 de septiembre del 2024. La Organización Mundial de la Salud se prepara para iniciar una campaña de vacunación contra la polio en Gaza después de que Israel acuerde una pausa parcial de 3 días. Las fuerzas israelíes continúan el ataque mortal contra Jenin en Cisjordania y dejan a Tulkarm y Tubas en ruinas. Un tribunal de Corea del Sur